about something ever so important and interesting, at least to me alone, if not to hopefully some other people. So, the Buddha's last words on his deathbed, or I guess death mat, his death lying on the ground, is recorded in the Parinibbana Sutta. And it's interesting what the Buddha's last words were. He prefaces by saying all the things that are fabricated by the mind, the sankharas, are inconstant and insufficient for lasting peace and happiness. That's just him setting it up, and that's he said that many other times throughout the canon, that the fabrications, the things we add to our experience, the things of the mind are inconstant. But the big, important, final words are achieve completion, i.e. you get to nibbana, or lasting peace, through, and then he used the word apamada, which means heedfulness. He didn't use the word sati, mindfulness. Sati, or mindfulness, is part of apamada, or heedfulness, but heedfulness is something bigger, and it's a really important concept to the path, because it's really the way we practice the spiritual path throughout life. And to understand why staying heedful and what it is and why it's important, I'm going to sort of start it a little bit at the beginning, which is just to remind us about karma, which is the very psychological teaching, which is the way we use the mind creates the mind we're going to live in the future. If we do or think unskillful, stressful, hurtful, harmful thoughts, then we're going to live in that kind of landscape, mental landscape in the future. Likewise, if we live in thoughts that are peaceful and relaxed and compassionate, we're going to live in a peaceful, relaxed, compassionate mind. Neuroscientists have a term for this. There was a great neuroscientist who came up with the Hebbian theory, which has been proved by the neuroscientist and Nobel Prize laureate, Eric Kandel. And the Hebbian theory goes like this. Summarized, it's neurons that fire together get wired together. When you think something a lot, it becomes hardwired in your brain. Neurons that fire together get wired together. What it means is that when neurons start firing in tandem, when you have a thought, and thoughts are made up of a lot of neurons that are firing, the more we think it, whether it's a thought or an action, these neurons, because they're firing so constantly together in tandem, start to synaptically hardwire themselves together. Repetition is the key to the mind developing habits. In other words, look at it this way. The first, I'll use a personal example. The first month I learned to play the banjo, it sucked. It really sucked, just like when I learned to play the accordion. I choose the fucking worst instrument you could possibly choose. I choose the ones that seem, if I had added the clarinet, I would have chosen the three most painful instruments there are. But so the banjo is the kind I play, the sort of old-time banjo, is a really awkward rhythm called the clawhammer, which is completely different than every other rhythm. It's not like strumming, and you play it in a really weird way. And so for the first month, when the mind is doing it, just trying to fire the neurons together to get the hand to move in the right rhythm, it's really painful. Just like when you're learning, I guess, a tennis backstroke, or you're learning how to do something on a computer. The first month, It's really, really hard because we're trying to figure out which neurons to fire to get the whole thing working. But then after about 3 weeks or a month, the neurons start to synaptically wire. And then they become wired to an area of the brain called the basal ganglia, which means they become increasingly habitually and motorily, motorifically, I don't know what the word is, they become much more compact and economical and require less conscious override. They just happen automatically. So if you've ever learned a game or a sport or, you know, how to ride a bike, the first, you know, 20 times you do something, we kind of suck at it, most of us, and then eventually the neurons firing together create habit, create ease of motion, and then they become stored in places like the basal ganglia and the striatum, which record habitual motions. And then there's a saying that if you do something 10,000 times, you become a genius at it, simply through repetition. I told this to a friend who snarkily replied, "Well, then I'm a genius at masturbation, because that's the only thing I've done 10,000 times." Actually, I thought that was pretty brilliant. He didn't even came to him like that. So you get it. The things you repeat in the mind create the mind in the future. Now, there's another factor that also creates habit and long-term memory and future states of the mind, and that's passion or real emotive responses to events. There's a lot of good neuroscience that shows that the thing that stores memories and stores traumatic events and stores things is important, which causes us to bring them back up into the mind's consciousness, is when we experience something and we release a lot of cortisol and a lot of adrenaline and a lot of dopamine, this sort of emotional, passionate underpinning creates firmly lodged memories. So repetition and passion seem to be the keys for creating the mind that we're going to live in. Indeed, as I was talking about last week, if you give a beta blocker to somebody who's been in a car crash right afterwards, and you stop the mind from and the body from having this traumatic response, the chances of them having PTSD are greatly decreased. So if you can somehow stop the sort of physical, impassioned response to an event, you can go a long way to keeping things that you don't want in the mind from being hardwired. Just as if, so for example, if you have a thought that causes a lot of fear, the fear will actually ingrain that thought. If whenever you think about money, you suddenly get physically tight and really, really emotional, that's going to hardwire it just as much as repeating the thought, oh, I don't know if I'll have enough money, if I'm going to go broke, if I can pay the rent. So those two factors, repetition and passion, tend to really create hardwiring in the mind, which creates the mental landscape. And this is the fundamentals of karma. Karma is not a teaching about the outside world, it's a teaching about how our mind works. It's a very, very astute observation by the Buddha. So the Buddha, when he said the key is apamatta, or heedfulness, he's talking about developing factors throughout our lives that will keep us from not repeating and not getting inflamed and overly passionate about things that we don't want to be in the mind in the future. This is what will keep the mind calm, relaxed, peaceful, and disengaged from constantly repeating unskillful thoughts, harmful thoughts. So I'm going to list them off and go over them very quickly. The first is, of course, starting from the inside, the most inward-focused practice to the most outwards. is meditation, bhavana. Meditation is simply the practice daily of dropping whatever stories we've been living in for that express purpose of detaching and getting the ability or developing the ability to stop the mind from repeating obsessive stories that will eventually hardwire themselves into the striatum and cause us suffering in the future. If we don't know how to stop ourselves from worrying or repeating or obsessing about something, it will always be there. That's the kind of mind we're going to live in. It might not always be there consciously, but it'll always be there potentially. And just when we don't want it, it will be triggered because it'll be hardwired into the brain. So we don't want to I'm not speaking as grammatically as I said, we don't want to increase the hard wiring of fear and worry in the brain, in the neural centers of the caudate nucleus and the striatum. We want to, in fact, make sure that those neural networks, as they're called, are not more and more hardwired. And each time we obsess about something, that's what we're doing. We're hardwiring the brain. So there's always an opportunity to stop this process. It's never too late. The wonderful thing about the brain is that it's neurally plastic. It can rewire itself. Just as you can have things that become hardwired, like traumas, those traumas can become depotentiated or unwired. So it's a very important practice to stop every day, to take yourself out of the story, the drama, the narratives, to take yourself out of the repetitive worries and fears and whatever you're living in, and to become present. Because after all, the most destructive thoughts we generally have are thoughts about things that are not happening in the present. When you look in the present, almost invariably, all of the horror stories are not here. If there's a horror story in the mind, it's almost always about what's going to happen in the future or something that it thinks happened in the past. But when you look around, almost invariably, in the present, that horror story is not there. So by dropping that tendency to go to places that are not real, i.e. the future, or stories about the past, and to stay present, and to drop the narratives, because there is no narrative in the present moment, we're giving ourselves the ability to disrupt that repetition that leads to unwanted karma. Now, I should say, if there's things you want in the brain in the future, do repeat them a lot, right? If you want to live in a peaceful mind, practice developing peace by letting go of things that we have no control over, by cultivating compassion for ourselves and for others, goodwill. There's good things that can come about repetition. And that's why the Buddha talked about getting passionate about cultivating peace, because passion, again, leads to hardwiring. So if we become passionate about meditation, passionate about spiritual practice, that's a skillful use. Now, the second practice is sati, or mindfulness. And that means, this is, we're moving more and more outwards, even as we make the transition from meditation into dealing with the events of the rest of life. We bring, as we were talking about earlier, an awareness of what's going on in the body, the breath, and the mind. So that we are not always completely consumed by the external world. We're not living with our entire awareness externally. There's also some awareness of what's going on inside, because you'll find that in life, when we make great mistakes, it's because we're stressed out. When we say things we don't want to say, when we do something really harmful, it's often because there's this underlying physical stress that we're not aware of, and we're literally so uncomfortable within that we're taking it out on people outside of us. The more comfortable we are physically, the more comfortable and calm the mind is, the less we're likely to act unskillfully in the world. And the way we do that is by being aware of what's going on inside. We keep a balance. That's why the Buddha's path is called the middle way. It's about balance. It's about not being entirely innerly focused or entirely externally focused. It's about a balance between the two. Having just enough inner awareness that we don't act unskillfully, we don't develop unnecessary stress, but also external awareness so that we act skillfully in the world. The third factor is the sila, or the precepts, which means making an intention to not act harmfully. And what this means is, well, the precepts are defined as not killing, stealing, lying, and causing harm through sex or intoxication. What it really means is setting an intention to be aware of what the goals are behind our actions. Really, the honest goal. What are we trying to get when we're about to do something? As the Buddha taught his son Rahula, when he summarized the path to his very young son, he said, you can practice this path simply by asking yourself before you do an action, is the intention to cause harm here? Or is the intention not to cause harm? Do we think that harm would be a likely result? So basically, this is a very much a practice of staying honest with what our motivations are and what our intentions are. Seeing what's really going on behind the scenes. When I'm talking to someone, am I just trying to get over on them? Or am I trying to somehow manipulate them? What's really happening behind the scenes? So, number four is gratitude. Gratitude is probably one of the most under-practiced parts of the spiritual practice. We tend to live in minds that are constantly looking around, thinking that, you know, I don't really have enough to be really happy right now. There's something missing. I could practice, I could act skillfully, but I think there's still something missing. There's something I need to get. I need to get one more, you know, advanced course in meditation, or one more diploma, slightly better job. If only I could get rid of that roommate. If only, then I'd be really peaceful if I got just a slightly better, or if that asshole at work wasn't there. Or if I got a relationship, or if I ended this relationship, or if only my computer didn't crash. There's always this if only. The mind has a tendency to live in this sense of not having, rather than living from a place of abundance. So gratitude is definitely refocusing the mind away from this not having and projecting to this future state where we believe we'll have all the things we need to relax and be peaceful. Oh, when I get to vacation, I'll be able to relax. When I get to the weekend, I'll be able to relax. Gratitude focuses the mind on what we've accomplished skillfully right here and right now, and also what other people have done for us, so that we don't feel victimized by life. This is really important. As one teacher of mine has said, you know, every time we eat, which in my case is probably more than I should, but every time we eat, somebody has probably been exploited, right? The vegetables that I eat didn't just jump off the ground into my bowl. Somebody was paid a small wage to pick it. Somebody was paid a wage to package it or drive it. Somebody was paid a wage to unstock it and put it on the shelves. Am I aware of that? Most of the time, no. But when I am, there's this great sense of peace and this diminishment of feeling alone and at odds with the world, and that I'm alone responsible, that I'm alone, that that my happiness is so unlikely. Because then I begin to see just how truly I'm how lucky I am, really. That creates an entirely different mind state. It really rips me out of that mind state of, I've got, you know, I don't have enough. If only I could get to this other place in life. And it really makes me see just how truly enriched each moment already is. And finally, generosity. Generosity, of course, is really rips us out of that mind state of worrying about how much we have and worrying about losing stuff, because we're, by the act of giving, even of our time, our awareness, our help, just calling up and checking in with somebody or listening when somebody's in pain, that kind of giving truly undermines the mind state that causes suffering, which is again a very isolated mind state that feels disconnected from everybody else, and that our suffering is unique and that we can't be of help to anyone. In short, if we've there's opportunities all the time to be heedful, to practice interrupting the unskillful mind states of worrying about how much we have, worrying about what other people think about us, worrying what's going to happen to me in the future, thinking that I don't have enough right now or that I won't be able to be happy until some imaginary future state. There's endless opportunities to interrupt those unskillful thought patterns and replace them with thought patterns that are skillful. Even when we're sick, that's a great time when the mind, when we're sick, is in its worst state because the body feels bad. And the mind, often when I get sick, the first thing it tells me is like, what happens if I always feel this way? That's the kind of mind I naturally have. And so I have to be sure not to react with fear to that thought. And I just say, oh, hello, worry. I see you. I know you're there. It's like when the Buddha said that to Mara, he was, I know that you're there. He was talking to his own unskillfulness, his own greed, his own aversion. He said, I see you. I see that you're there. I know. But he didn't get worked up or frustrated. And that's why in meditation we don't get worked up or frustrated. And that's why when we're sick or when we're tired or when we're lonely, we can practice heedfulness all the time. Each time we're in a new mind state, instead of attaching to it, repeating it, and getting worked up by it, we just notice it. We make sure the body's relaxed. We make sure that we don't get worked up. We just see whatever's going on, aware of it, knowing it's there, but not being thrown, so that we can decide, oh, is this something that I really want to have in my mind in the future? Or is this mind state something that I would be better off without? So there's always opportunities. the subway, the shower, you name it. So that's my talk tonight. What the Buddha meant by stay heedful on his deathbed, appamatta, how to practice and keep the mind as peaceful, planting the seeds for happiness in the future. So I thank you for listening. And